Welcome to the MS News Today podcast. I'm your host, Jen Powell, and I also have secondary progressive multiple sclerosis. I am a columnist with MS News Today at multiplesclerosisnewstoday.com. Welcome to the Multiple Sclerosis Podcast. I am your host, Jen Powell. Joining us today is someone very special to me, my own neurologist, Dr. Brandon Bieber. Dr. Brandon Bieber is a neuroimmunologist and specialist in multiple sclerosis and other autoimmune diseases of the nervous system. Growing up in Los Angeles, ever since he was young, he's had an interest in health, science, and medicine. After obtaining an undergraduate degree at the University of California at Berkeley in molecular and cellular biology with an emphasis in genetics and development, he attended medical school in Philadelphia at Drexel University College of Medicine. His internal medicine internship and neurology residency training were at Kaiser Permanente's Los Angeles Medical Center, and he completed a fellowship in multiple sclerosis and neuroimmunology at USC. He now resides in Los Angeles and is a neuroimmunologist at Kaiser Permanente.
Good to see you, Jen.
Good to see you. Dr. Bieber is a friend of the show, and it's always nice to have you with us. Dr. Bieber, I've always had such admiration for how you take a concept and you put it on YouTube, and it will be a completely foreign concept, but you break it down with such illustrious imagery so that we can understand it. How did you get involved in that? What made you start to do that? Because I understand things that I couldn't understand if I read them in a book, and I'm pretty smart.
Well, originally, many, many years ago, I wanted to be a teacher, actually, and I didn't get interested in medicine until late high school. And I actually taught a class when I was in college, so I'm interested in education. You know, I even have some medical students that come through occasionally. I'm not an academic. I don't work at a major university, but I've just always been interested in teaching. A lot of the language of medicine, especially the language of MS, is very obtuse and strange. And I feel like a lot of doctors often don't understand it. And I always found it to be helpful when someone can just clearly break things down to the level of a five-year-old so that everyone can understand it. And, you know, that's the way that I like to be taught and talked to. So that's kind of the style I adopted.
I like it. And, you know, as I think the words are hard enough to pronounce, but then throw in some dysarthria, dysphagia, and they always come out real funky. So what I enjoy is being able to go to your YouTube channel and really better understand facets of this disease. I think when we better understand and become educated about it, we can better advocate for ourselves as patients.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's impossible to 100% trust someone, even if you have a highly qualified doctor. The more you know how to ask the right questions and you're familiar with the side effects of medications so that you know if something is going wrong. And it just gives you more opportunities.
It does. And that brings me to a good point. I think a lot of people, I mean, and I really encourage people to have a trusting relationship with their physician, because I do think we need to lean on the expertise that we don't have as patients and understand there's a line there that we don't know what we don't know. But what we do know is how we feel. Sometimes, like in my own MS, I can feel my body changing, but my MRI might not say it. Or I know people have gotten confused by being classified in like secondary progressive MS, which I have. And it's active and classified as advanced, but I'm not in a wheelchair. I am if I need long distance. I know the stages are so confusing to many. And why is there so much confusion among classifications? I mean, to me, people.
Well, there's confusion to everyone, even me. I mean, my personal opinion is that the clinical classifications are a little bit arbitrary. In general, there are two ways that people with MS report they're getting worse. One is they have an attack, also known as a relapse or flare or exacerbation, which is a relatively dramatic worsening over a short period of time, usually several days, like having pain and vision loss in one eye or numbness and weakness of the legs that develop pretty quickly. And the other way that people could get worse is more of a very slow, insidious change. For instance, someone saying, you know, nothing major changed, but over the last few years, I just can't walk as far. I have to rest, you know, especially if it's a hot day. They can't say exactly when it started, but they can tell that they aren't as functional as they were in the past. And in general, you know, younger people are more likely to have relapses, the distinctive attacks, and older people are more likely to report the insidious progression. But it's highly variable. Some older people do have relapses, and some younger people, unfortunately, do have progressive MS. And also, there's increasing evidence that even young people with relapsing MS with low disability, some of them have some progression. It's just kind of subtle, and they may not complain about it very much because they're doing well overall. You know, if someone who can easily walk 5 miles isn't going to complain as much as someone who has a lot of difficulty just walking around in their house, though they both could have some degree of progression. And, you know, the distinction between relapsing MS and secondary progressive MS, you know, sometimes it's a little bit difficult to tell because doctors can't detect a subtle progression that easily. You know, I'm not going to have someone go outside with me during the appointment and try to walk a few miles. Unfortunately, it's just not practical. And my opinion is that the diseases, primary progressive MS and secondary progressive MS, are simply exactly the same disease.
Interesting. Explain that a little more for our listeners.
Well, to give an example, I have a patient who I saw when she was around 65 years old, and she complained that her walking was getting worse. It was difficult for her to walk long distances. And, you know, on exam, she had signs of leg weakness, and MRI scan showed she had lesions typical of multiple sclerosis. And, you know, I asked, have you ever had any prior neurological symptoms? And she said no. So I diagnosed her with primary progressive MS. Primary just means that the first form of MS was progressive. There was no history of relapsing MS. However, as an afterthought, she mentioned to me, oh, you know, when I was 30 years old, I had optic neuritis. So she did have prior symptoms. She just didn't realize they were connected. So she actually has secondary progressive MS.
Got
Now,
it.
do you think people can remember everything that ever happened to them in their whole life? And of course, someone could have some numbness, think it's carpal tunnel syndrome, it goes away, but it was actually an MS relapse. You
Right.
know, so it's a little bit difficult to define. And there's a lot of evidence that the average rate of progression is roughly the same in people with primary and secondary progressive MS. The MRI findings are similar. The cerebrospinal fluid findings are similar. Response to medication tends to be similar. So my opinion is they're the same disease. And this is actually a big deal because in clinical trials, they're often separated. And that makes it harder to recruit and fund the clinical trials. And I wish they would just combine them together. I don't think it makes sense to put on an FDA or EMA label. This disease modifying therapy only works for secondary progressive MS or only works with primary progressive MS. I don't believe it personally.
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, especially if it's presenting similarly, and if what the mechanisms that are happening in the body are synonymous, it makes complete sense. Also, great segue. Speaking of clinical trials, I will be the ominous 56 on Saturday, which means, well, I think 55 was the cutoff, but I no longer matter to clinical trials. It's like you hit a certain age and you're irrelevant in the space of what you can be included for clinical trials. And you're changing that landscape a little, aren't you?
Well, I'd like to. I wouldn't say that I
You
am,
want
but
to change
something is
it.
changing. I would like to change that. I
Yeah,
don't think I'm
that's
very influential, unfortunately. But you're not the first person to say that. And you're not insignificant. I mean, we would want you to participate and be included in these things. Historically, it's true though. Most clinical trials excluded people over age 55 and excluded people who had a higher level of existing disability. And I know a lot of people have negative views of pharmaceutical companies, but it's not really a conspiracy or anything. It's just that pharmaceutical companies have limited resources. They want to make their drugs look good. So people who are older, they do have a higher rate of complications for certain medications, especially immunosuppressants. And also, they do have a higher rate of just getting random diseases, not even related to the drug, like pneumonia or a heart attack or cancer. And even one person randomized to the drug who gets cancer or a heart attack can potentially make their drug look bad. Doctors make a big deal about one serious side effect, even if it wasn't clearly related to the drug, just because, the sample sizes in these trials isn't that large. And also, in terms of higher existing disability, the problem is sometimes it's a little bit hard to measure whether a medication is effective. So there's a scale used in MS research called the EDSS, or Expanded Disability Status Scale. And the problem with the scale is it's not very sensitive to changes when someone has a higher level of existing disability. For instance, let's say you need a cane to walk 100 meters because your balance isn't good. Your EDSS is probably 6.0. Let's say you get significantly worse and now you can only walk very short distances, but you can still get around a little bit with a cane. You don't need a walker. Well, your EDSS is still 6.0. Let's say you've become demented in that time. You have significant cognitive impairment. Well, your EDSS is still 6.0. So how do you prove that your drug is better if everyone is pretty static in terms of their score? So historically, they excluded people with higher levels on this scale. What I was trying to advocate for is the use of composite outcomes, such as the MS functional composite, which measure things like time 25-foot walk and a test called the 9-hole peg test, a test of upper extremity function, and cognitive testing, such as the PACAT, for example. And this is more sensitive to picking up smaller differences and still works in older people who may have more disability. I actually got people to sign a petition and send it to the FDA, but I didn't get a response back. So I don't think I'm that influential, unfortunately.
Don't give up. We need you. And I also want to reiterate, I am not at all knocking pharmaceutical companies because I do understand there is kind of a sweet spot where we really can maximize efficacy of drugs. And when you get to, someone older, you're also going to have more comorbidities. Your control group's not as steady. And so you're going to have influential aspects that are going to ruin your control group. So I understand that there are reasons. But, as you get older, I think your body changes anyway and independent of MS. And sometimes it's hard to know what it is. Is it changing on a cellular level because we're aging? Is it changing due to the multiple sclerosis? Especially because so many of like my own changes are subtle, yet if I look year over year, they're huge, but they're not sudden, right? So they're not like, aha, I don't have an epiphany and wake up with a relapse. Do you notice that aging affects multiple sclerosis?
It does affect MS. On the average, with aging, there's a lower risk of having relapses and a lower risk of having new lesions on the MRI. But unfortunately, people can still have subtle progression. And this varies a lot from person to person. Some people could have a plateau phase where they may progress for a period, but then be stable. And I've seen that many times. Some people with progressive MS can actually have significant improvements. That is, unfortunately less common, but it definitely can happen. But unfortunately, the progression of MS can happen at any age. And, even if people have been stable for many years, I have been seen some people have progression when they're much older. My experience is that a lot of people sometimes attribute their symptoms to aging when it's really due to MS. They don't complain, they feel okay, but they're walking slower. But when I examine them, I can see there are objective changes like increased weakness, increased tremor, increased sensory loss, even if their MRI scans are stable. I mean, certainly aging is a real thing and people can get other things and arthritis, but often I think it is related to MS. When people notice a decline, I think it's usually related to MS.
I'm also wondering if it wouldn't be useful. I mean, I know it's done, but we have the quantitative studies, right, that have data around disability and whatnot. But how useful is it for people aging to have kind of a qualitative study as well, or something to measure quality of life on a more subjective scale, right? Because I mean, I think that has a lot to do with aging with a disease, how we choose to live with it, right? How are we facing our disease? How does that affect disease progression, all things being equal? Have you found that to be a factor on like attitude or coping mechanisms?
Well, I think it's an absolutely legitimate outcome. Some things can't be measured, for example, like fatigue and pain. It's hard to measure that except ask the person with MS. And that's another thing. We're seeing a lot of studies are including, for example, a survey called the MS Quality of Life Survey. And, people are reporting their fatigue, how much they're able to do, how much they have to rest, how much pain they have, what they think about their subjective cognitive function. I think that's a 100% legitimate outcome.
And I'm wondering only because I and myself, I know I have known you for quite a long time. And when I first met you, I was almost 50 pounds heavier. And you've always been an advocate of really taking care of yourself to meet the disease. And I say that now because I think anytime we take care of ourselves mentally or physically, we're better able to meet MS. MS, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, two diseases is worse than one. So, obviously, I don't think that we have definitive proof for a single lifestyle. There's some evidence for example, a whole foods plant-based diet studied at Oregon Health Sciences University that had some benefits on fatigue, for example, in people with MS. Dr. Terry Walls is an advocate of a paleo-type diet. She's done some very nice randomized trials, for instance, comparing her diet to the Swank diet. So there is some evidence for these things, maybe not definitive evidence, but even if they didn't help for MS, if you're eating a diet where you're eating a lot of whole fruits and vegetables, minimizing processed foods and exercising regularly, you're going to be in better fitness overall. You're going to be less likely to get other diseases like diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure. You're going to need less other medications. And yeah, I have some patients that have significant disability due to MS. They have significant leg weakness, but they can still get around because they're relatively fit and healthy overall. So I think it makes a big difference.
Yeah, I do too. As a matter of fact, I recently read Dr. Walls has, I think, one of the only longitudinal studies using diet right now or nutrition. And I think that's going on in Iowa or at the University of Iowa. I'm not clear, but that would be interesting to see the influence of nutrition on disease, although I'm sure there's many different factors that contribute. But in your purview with the plant-based diet, what is it about a plant-based diet? Is it the inflammation that you reduce that helps your multiple sclerosis?
I don't think there's a way to know. Some of the old studies by Dr. Rory Swank in Norway found that, in regions where people tend to eat more beef and dairy, there were higher rates of multiple sclerosis. So we see that from an epidemiologic standpoint, that in areas of the world where people consume more dairy and saturated fat, there are higher rates of MS. Now, that's not, strong evidence. There are other things going on, the overall development of the economy, sunlight exposure, things that are sort of confounded with diet. But it may be better to eat more whole fruits and vegetables. It's hard to say if it's due to one specific thing. Dr. Swank believed that saturated fats got into the cell membranes and had these pro-inflammatory effects. Another theoretical factor would be like the ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 fatty acids. Like historically, it's believed our ancestors may have a ratio of omega-6 to omega-3 consumption of around 4 to 1 or 2 to 1. But in modern times, it's more like 25 to 1. And a lot of it is eating like processed seed oils, like corn oil and things like that. And there is some basic science evidence that omega-6 fatty acids in high amounts are more pro-inflammatory, so no one knows for sure, but those are some potential mechanisms.
There's a couple of things that have come up lately, not lately, but I guess in the past few years, so many people have indicated that vitamin D in high levels may not be as effective as they once thought. Can you explain more about that if that's something that's legitimate? I never know what to believe because there's always so much information.
Well, I don't know what to believe either. I do recommend my patients take vitamin D. I actually take vitamin D myself. I have it on my desk. It's
He's
the
holding up
only
vitamin D,
vitamin.
not lying.
It's the only vitamin I take. I don't take anything else. I don't take a multivitamin. There's a lot of evidence for an association between vitamin D levels and MS. People with low vitamin D are more likely to get MS. People with MS with lower levels of vitamin D seem to have a worse prognosis. There are studies looking at relapse rates, for example. However, in terms of like the interventional trials giving vitamin D versus placebo, almost all of those studies suggest that it doesn't really do anything. So, me personally, I think the evidence is weak. I think it's very likely that vitamin D is not an effective treatment for MS. I just recommend it just in case. As an explanation for how this could occur, it could be due to confounding. So, if you're exposed to the sun, it raises your vitamin D level. And there's some evidence that ultraviolet radiation has some beneficial effects on regulating the immune system. And also people with MS who are healthier and more active and doing better, they're going to be outside more, exercising more, getting more sunlight exposure. So that's a possible explanation of why we're seeing this correlation. But vitamin D at reasonable doses is extraordinarily safe. Just keep this in mind that if someone like me, I have type 1 skin, I go out into the sun for 10 minutes in sunny Southern California, I can get 10,000 international units in literally less than 10 minutes. So if you're taking 5,000 international units of vitamin D3 once a day, that's very low risk. There are some exceptions, people who have a history of calcium-containing kidney stones, but for most people, it's very safe.
Right. Thank you. You're obviously incredibly smart. You educate people through social media. You have a thriving practice. How do you stay motivated to treat people and to just keep contributing to your patients and as well as on platforms to help educate the community?
Well, the people with MS motivate me. I meet some extraordinary people, and some with significant disabilities who are still trying to live life, take care of their families, work if they can, do amazing things, do the best they can in the face of adversity, and I want to help them to live the best life they can. I think a lot of doctors, after a while, they want to do something other than their core career. Some people publish incredible research. Some people are involved in teaching, in social media, medical writing. It's just something I do on the side to keep my career interesting. I think it's something anyone has to do if they want to have a long career and not get burnt out.
Well, and we're going to have the link to your YouTube on this episode's description. It's quite dynamic, and I think you have somewhere around 37,000 followers. You've got, or maybe more, but that's only YouTube. You've got a whole nother, I think you're also on, you're on X and other forums, but you've got quite a repertoire and quite a following. So,
Well, thank you.
what is your primary source of fun for you, Dr. Bieber? If you, in your own life, what do you like to do to regroup?
These days I spend a lot of time with my family. I've got a wife and kids, so
I
I'm
love
pretty
that.
busy and with them. I spend less time with my friends than I used to when I was younger. But I like to exercise. I like to stay fit. I like to jog. In the past, I ran the LA Marathon 4 times. I'm not fit like that, like I used to be or anything. But I like to stay in shape. I play chess. I do circus arts a little bit. I like to read, that kind of thing.
Oh, good for you. That sounds really good. And it's no wonder. I mean, you contribute so much. On behalf of the MS community, thank you. I hope that you know that I want to mark that comment that you might not have had an impact. Maybe that one time. Keep going because you have an impact on me and everyone else in the world. So keep it up. What message would you like to leave our listeners? I always end with the same question.
Well, so you brought up the frustration that you have and many others have about, maybe not being able to get access to some clinical trials. I'm happy to report that does seem to be changing. Now that we have a lot of medications for both relapsing and progressive MS, I think that pharmaceutical companies are starting to think, okay, well, what can we do for people who are 70 years old, who've had MS for a long time, who do have walking difficulties? They want to prove that their drugs are effective in these people. And it's very important because, as a doctor, I couldn't tell you which drug is best in that sort of person. We just don't have good randomized trial evidence. Just to give a few examples, there's a trial called the FENtrepid trial, which is studying the investigational drug fenebrutinib, which is not yet FDA approved for MS, but it's a Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor being studied in both relapsing and progressive MS. And it's being compared to Ocrevus in a head-to-head trial. And in that trial, you can be up to 65 years old. So 65 is the new 55.
I
And
like it.
in the United Kingdom, Professor Klaus Schmeierer, who's very active on X, he is doing a study called the Chariot MS study on the drug cladribine, Mavenclad, and he's actually testing it on people who have an EDSS up to 8.5. So 6 is requiring a cane, 8.5 is a fairly significant amount of disability. And so he's trying to show that this drug is effective even in people who have a significant amount of existing disability, and they're going to look at other outcomes, cognitive outcomes, function of the upper extremities, that kind of thing. And there's some other studies as well. So the world hasn't forgotten about you. And, I think that with MS or any chronic disease, it's natural for people to go through periods where they don't want to think about MS. They're just living life, which is totally normal. And, I would do the same thing. And of course, periods where people are very active and interested and doing a lot of reading and research. And, I think you have to give yourself credit, whether you're doing a small thing, like maybe cutting out late night snacking or doing a few physical therapy sessions, or doing a big thing, like a major change in lifestyle, or trying to enter a clinical drug trial, which takes a lot of time and effort, by the way. And I appreciate anyone who pursues it. That's the only way we learn anything about these medicines in the first place. I think you have to give yourself some credit and for and some grace, because this is a difficult disease to battle, and anything you can do for yourself that's positive is a good thing.
Oh, I like those words, Dr. Bieber. Thank you. I think it stands to reason that many people would love to find a better way to, like, in the absence of the brass ring being a cure, how do we live a more improved quality of life with the disease while we're on our journey, right? And I very much appreciate you being part of that. So you're helping us live a more improved quality of life, and just keep going. Don't give up. We need you.
Thanks, Jen. I won't give up, and neither should you either.
How can I? Nope, never gonna give up. So, Dr. Bieber, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you, and thank you to our listeners today at MS News Today. This is the Multiple Sclerosis Podcast. I'm your host, Jen Powell. Share your thoughts on this episode through social media. You can find MS News Today on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Follow us to keep updated on the latest news and to never miss new content and initiatives. Click the links in this episode's description.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to Multiple Sclerosis News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.multiplesclerosisnewstoday.com. And be sure to follow us on social media and join our Multiple Sclerosis News Today forums, a trusted MS community ready to welcome you anytime.